Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And it's the Second Reading Podcast for Monday, the 8th of August. Today, we'll talk about some more action on the Texas voter ID law, more maneuvering on the abortion front in Texas, and another Texas blip in the 2016 presidential race. So let's start with a voter ID, Josh. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project. I'm here with Josh Blank, who I prematurely introduced. How's your weekend, Josh?
Wonderful. Wonderfully relaxing.
Well, I like the sound of that.
Yeah.
Mine was sort of like that, but then not so much.
Okay.
So let's start with voter ID. One of the, at least for the 21st century, shall we say, perennial issues in Texas politics, and with some national connections. And last month, we had more legal action on the voter ID front. So let's go back and talk about where this voter ID law came from.
Right. In 2011, the Texas legislature passed Texas's voter ID law, which was sort of instantly dubbed the strictest in the country. And the reason it was the strictest was because of the limited list of identification that people could present at the polls. It included a driver's license, basically a military ID, a concealed carry license, I think like a passport, I believe. Yeah. And there was one other, I think a citizenship certificate if it had your photo on it.
Right. However,
does not include, university IDs. And the other issue is basically, the question is, the distribution of ID holding in the state was what quickly became the big issue, as it does everywhere with voter ID laws.
Right, as well as, and then I think subsidiary to that, but it still came up in the proceedings was, once again, Texas's size kind of mattered. Mm-hmm. Because the cost and inconvenience of traveling for some people in areas that were distant from places where they could legitimately get one of these IDs was an issue. One of the big things we heard, though, was the exclusion of student IDs from this really made it look a lot like it was purposefully designed to not enable, to not make it easier for students to vote.
Yeah, and Democratic-leaning groups more generally, right? So college students tend to be a little bit more Democratic-leaning. But to the extent that, you think about individuals who don't have a driver's license or a state ID card, they tend to disproportionately be made up of minorities,
right?
Some older individuals, newcomers to the country, that sort of thing. And so, for those reasons, these laws have become, partisan in nature, but they didn't actually start that way, which is kind of interesting just in terms of some of the history.
At least in the view of the public.
Yeah, in the view of the public.
I mean, it was hard not to view them as partisan in nature, given that, to my recollection, every state, and these are laws that are passed at the state level.
Right.
Because elections are a matter of state jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
Every state that passed these did have a Republican legislature and I think a Republican governor.
Right. That's true. That's
right, so
correct.
They were dominated by Republicans. And so from the beginning, it had, for people watching the process, a kind of unavoidable political tint to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think your point about public opinion is really important, because when we polled on this in Texas, and I think there were some indications of this in other statewide polling, there seemed to be kind of relatively broad bipartisan support for this.
Right. I mean, these laws really only started in the mid to late early aughts, I guess
right.
They say, right, in the aughts. So 2006,
I
think, 2008. It is terrible.
Aughts.
Yeah. No, that's true. I've been reading a book recently where it keeps referring to the aughts, and it always just clangs in your ear. Anyway, when this started, this is the sort of law that, people are generally, if they don't know anything about it, they don't know about sort of the fact, the partisan background of it, the distribution of ID holding and that kind of thing. People just say like, yeah, don't I already present an ID at the polls? And that's what most people actually thought. And when you polled, most people thought they had to present
their
photo ID.
The first time we polled on this, we asked about people opposing or supporting the voter ID law. got a decent majority, a large majority, I think 71%, something like this, in favor of it.
Yeah, Democrats, Republicans.
I remember that because a Republican, Troy Frazier, I think this is before you were on the Texas Politics Project, actually quoted the poll in favor of voter ID from the floor of the Senate.
Great.
Not exactly what we had in mind.
Yeah,
but,
well,
you know,
it's okay.
The Trumpian school of all no publicity is bad publicity, we took it.
The poll is a public service.
But in that same poll, we had a smaller but still sizable majority thought that it was actually already the law.
Yeah, and national polls that have looked at this basically find that most people at the time that these laws started to be implemented just assumed that you presented your driver's license at the polls.
Yeah, and in Texas, I think the you know that comes from the just people's physical experience. You get the little card in the mail that says that you've registered to vote, that hopefully all of you have. And then you put it on a magnet on the fridge, or you put it in the mail pile, or you put it in a special place. Mm-hmm. And then election day comes and you can't find it.
Right.
And you go to the polling place in the previous regime and they'd say, hey, do you have your voter registration card? And you say, no. So do you have your voter ID? Do you have a photo ID? Do you have your driver's license? And you go, yep. And you show them your driver's license. They match your driver's license to the voter ID list and they let you vote.
Now, I'm originally from New York, and you go in New York, and they literally just have these old ledger books, and you show up, and they're like, yep, that's me, and they say, okay, and you just vote. So it's a little bit, I mean, it's different everywhere.
That's New York values.
And that's a New York value.
That's what Ted Cruz would call New York values, Josh.
We're pro-democracy. We let anyone vote as many times as they want. Anyway, so what happened, though? This is the main thing. Let's get back to this, right? So basically, the law was ruled unconstitutional at the district level, basically, a little while back.
Right.
The state appealed it to the federal appeals court, and the federal appeals court agreed, basically, and said, you know, but you need to come up with something to fix this for the election.
Right. They didn't throw it out.
They didn't throw it out
entirely,
but they sent it back down and said, come up with an agreement. And what the news from last week was that the Texas Attorney General's office and the Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of Justice,
the Attorney General is in charge of this kind of litigation. When the state gets sued, it's up to the Attorney General. They're the lawyer for the state, among other things.
Right. So the agreement that they reached was basically anyone can go and vote without a photo ID. Now, it would be better to have a photo ID. So if you show up with a photo ID, it'll make it easier for you.
Right.
But if you don't have a photo ID, you can sign an affidavit, which is just a legal document that you're saying is true, that certifies your citizenship, and you just need to provide some form of a proof of residence, a paycheck, a utility bill, a bank statement, something that matches your address up with the address they have on file for you.
And your name.
That's it. Now, this still needs to be approved by the U.S. District Judge who heard the original case. They most likely will because, again,
both parties have agreed.
Right. Now, this isn't going to be what we have going forward. This is just for this election. The other big issue here is that the district judge still has to decide whether lawmakers intentionally discriminated against certain groups in passing this law. And that's a big deal.
So this was essentially a short-term agreement because the election is coming up and they needed to have something in place to decide how the law would apply for the election. And that's kind of the technical thing here, but it's happened over and over again.
Right.
You know, this law has been in court since the minute after it passed.
Right. And we've had two statewide elections under this law.
Right. And in fact, it's materially impacted an election that the litigation over this has mattered in various kinds of ways. So there'll be an agreement in place.
Right. Now what happened, the big deal though also is that if the district judge determines that lawmakers actually intentionally discriminated against certain groups, especially minority groups, then Texas goes back onto a preclearance list with the Department of Justice, which means the Department of Justice would have to approve any changes that Texas makes to their election laws in the future, which until very recently was actually the state that Texas was in until, I guess a recent Supreme Court decision that threw out that provision of the Voting Rights Act.
Right.
This is all really technical, but the point is that, Texas just escaped from being under the Justice Department's supervision for its election laws. If the Supreme Court decision that sort of threw out that sort of preclearance of Texas is what allowed this law to go forward and then actually be used in these elections, this would actually, if the district judge decided that Texas discriminated, we'd actually be back under preclearance.
We're under a different provision than the one that was thrown
right.
And
we'd
out.
Actually be, I think we'd be probably the first state back under preclearance.
Right. So the the technicality here goes back, and coincidentally, this weekend was the anniversary of the Voting Rights Act.
Oh, perfect. So,
and the Voting Rights Act was a piece of legislation from 1965 that basically provided for federal supervision of elections in states with a history of discrimination. Mm-hmm. For states and localities. Some of these were even cities, and you know, this has been in effect for over 50 years. It's been eroded and modified by Congress and eroded by the courts, mm-hmm. broadly speaking, but is still in effect and is a federal mechanism for supervising elections at the state level, which otherwise are really under the purview of states and localities.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if we're doing a good job, but voter ID is like this actually incredibly interesting area on a lot of different levels. You know, I think if you want to learn more about, you know, the prevalence of voter fraud and sort of the different types of voter fraud and how laws, you know, can or cannot combat those, there's a lot out there that you can read that's actually really interesting. But I think there's sort of two things I think we should focus on before we go to the next topic, right? One is, you know, sort of public opinion around voter ID, which we've kind of talked about a little bit, but it's sort of an interesting example. And the other is about, you know, laws around voting in general. And sort of misconceptions that people have about it. So why don't we – what do you want to do first?
So firstly, we do them in the order. Since we started public opinion and really wrap it up. So in terms of public opinion, what we saw, and interesting was Texas. I mean, this really intersects active politics. As we were saying earlier, you know, it's so fascinating because you don't see it that much that public opinion changed on this. Mm-hmm. Essentially, as we said, it started, everybody kind of thought commonsensically, oh, yeah, sure, voter ID. People should have to have a photo ID. Democrats started
making... an ID to pick a prescription drug sometimes.
Right. So I need an ID for everything. Get on a plane.
So why not?
So Democrats actually made a political issue out of this, put forth the arguments that were in the data that we suggested that, you know, this discriminated against, this had a discriminatory effect on... minorities, in some cases, the elderly, they thought.
Younger people.
And it turned Democratic public opinion, you know, and I suspect actually might have even pushed Republican opinion more in favor of it.
Yeah. And the big group, and we see this in our data, is the starkest is, you know, when we first started polling on this, you know, African-Americans were, you know, on average in favor of voter ID. And when the real shift came during the 2012 election, when Barack Obama was running for re-election, and they made a national issue out of this in states like North Carolina and some other swing states where Republican legislatures had passed these laws to say, hey, these are basically, you know, some version of 21st century poll taxes, or these are, you know, laws meant to discriminate against blacks.
Yeah, yeah. And African-American public opinion just shifted.
Shifted and went completely against it. And with it, Democratic opinion shifted and went completely against it. And now it's kind of has that sort of polarized, you know, the polarization that you come to expect in a lot of issues. So, I mean, even in the most recent polling we did on this, which was actually back in 2014, you know, 78% of Republicans had a very favorable opinion of the state's voter ID law, and only 23% of Democrats. That gives you a pretty good sense. That is also a sense why the state kind of, you know, in a lot of ways continues pushing forward with this. There's not a lot to lose for Republican statewide elected officials in pushing this voter ID law and continuing to fight for it because their constituents want it, and the fact is, you know, Democrats may not like it, but they're not a majority in the state.
Right.
So that's the one thing.
So the other thing was about just the nature of elections.
Right. I mean, I think that a lot of people look at these sorts of fights and say, you know, why, you know, I mean, let's say this. They accept the fact that this is political, right? Which the truth is, it probably is. You know, I mean, just to be fair here, you know, the fact is the people who are most likely to be affected by these laws vote Democratic overwhelmingly. They've only been passed by Republican legislatures and signed by Republican governors. Is this some sort of travesty on the, you know, the system of voting and democracy writ large? Not really, because the fact is that, you know, a little bit of history says, one, we've only expanded the right to vote over time. And the fact is, it's not like the country started off and it was like, hey, everybody, let's should vote.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Elections in the franchise have always been contested political terrain.
Right. And then the other side of it is that, you know, as Dr. Henson said earlier, you know, running elections is left up to the states. And by left up to the states, in most states, that means left up to elected officials in the state. The fact is the people who make the laws are politicians running in those elections, so that the exercise of making those laws is necessarily a political exercise. Determining who votes and who doesn't is something that's been going on forever, and it always has politics as part of it. So this is no different. It's not like a fundamental threat to our democracy. In fact, you know, more people can
vote now.
Especially
democracy at work.
It's true. And if anything, more people can vote now than ever could. And that's sort of something that we've been, you know, the long sort of trajectory.
It is one of the big things that I think we forget is that, you know, part of democracy is fighting over the rules themselves, you know, presumably within some basic, you know, large principled guidelines. And that's what the courts are sorting out here is, you know, you can fight over these rules,
right.
You can fight over how this is executed, but there are basic rules, like you can't try to exclude people.
Right.
Basically.
Right.
Okay, so let's move on to something a little cheerier.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, so we talked in when we talked about voter ID, we talked about public opinion shifting,
right,
and how interesting that is to us. One of the reasons it's interesting to us is because there are some areas where public opinion hardly shifts at all. It's rock-like. And one of those areas is abortion politics. And last week, it was really only in the state level and local news, but there was a bureaucratic hearing last week on a proposed new rule that would require hospitals and clinics, particularly abortion providers, it's important here, to either inter or cremate any fetal remains, whether from an abortion or from a miscarriage.
Right.
And this was a rule that was proposed relatively quietly by Governor Abbott a few months ago.
It was proposed at his direction. As the head of the executive branch.
Exactly. But it came to light in kind of a very political way.
Right. I think it's, you know, it's really easy to be, you know, skeptical and assume everything is political, especially from these chairs, you know. And I think it's healthy to try to not think of things as being political sort of as your starting point, to sort of take people at their word and face value that they're trying to do something. This was a little bit different, though, because no one really, you know, it wasn't a proposal that was very obvious, except for the fact that we all found out about it through a fundraising email from the governor. So that kind of tells you from the outset, oh, maybe this is something political, right?
Right. So we had a midweek last week, there was a hearing at HHS, and this is kind of a typical open government thing where if there's going to be some change in directive in an executive agency, you have a public hearing on these changes.
Usually there's a public comment period.
Right. And the public comment period was about to close when people discovered this, I think, or the deadline was getting close. And so what you had was, you know, as many of these abortion-related hearings are, a long day of very emotional testimony. And the idea here is that you heard from hospitals, from, you know, funeral homes about the costs involved here.
Which are apparently not minor.
Trivial.
Yeah.
Right.
They're in the low thousands of dollars, it sounds like.
Right. I mean, typically if you've been in, you know, if you've had the misfortune or, you know, the human experience of having a family member or somebody close to you die and been involved in funeral expenses, what you're essentially talking about is some degree of funeral services for the result of a failed or terminated pregnancy.
Right. And this is regardless of the age of gestation.
Right. And the rationale for this was twofold, to be, you know, even-handed about this. That is, it was supposed to be about women's health, but also about, from a more philosophical, ideological position, you know, it was really aimed at underlining the degree to which the results, you know, any results of a pregnancy should be afforded the status of human life.
Right.
So this drove a lot of the testimony. On one hand, you had a lot of very emotional testimony from women, including circumstances about in which, you know, having gone through some kind of a miscarriage or an abortion, just how awful it would be to have to go through this, particularly, you know, really at any point in the pregnancy. On the other hand, you had testimony about the risks of this, of the current means of disposing of fetal tissues. And
the main thing was, you know, I mean, I think the most, you know, you sort of, there's a certain set of usual suspects around abortion laws proposed or otherwise when they happen in the state, and you sort of have the regular pro-life groups. You also have a lot of the pro-choice groups, and then of course, you know, the abortion clinics. But I think that what was notable was a lot of sort of the hospitals and the funeral homes saying, "So who's going to pay for this?"
Right,
right.
And that really then gets us to some of the legal context of this. So this year there was a big Supreme Court case that threw out an abortion law that had been passed in Texas,
right, HB2 in 2013, which is this omnibus abortion legislation. This is very recent. You've probably heard about this. Was the, you know, doctors had to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles. Abortion or facilities that performed abortions, even non-surgical ones, had to meet the standards of ambulatory surgical centers. Which
means things like wider hallways.
Wide hallways where gurneys could fit and, you know, piping for anesthesia and all kinds of things. You know, I think the 20-week ban was in there, so you can't have an abortion after 20 weeks of gestation. That was part of that bill. So it was a lot of stuff that went on, and that law was just deemed unconstitutional. And actually, I mean, you know, sort of there's a Texas specific component to that and a national component to that, which is other states sort of saw Texas's approach to this, and it was sort of one of the big pushes in sort of abortion restricting legislation kind of came out of Texas with this law. And what made it notable, and you saw a lot of states following suit in the subsequent years, at least until the Supreme Court just struck this down and basically saying, we're doing this for women's health, we're doing this for women's safety, so that's okay, right? And there's a lot of thought that this was going to be the next front on sort of the abortion battle. And the Supreme Court said, no, this is, you know, you need to actually really severely impact women's health in a, you know, I mean, women's health is a fine argument, but you have to actually show it. You can't just say it.
Right.
And they basically,
and there was very little evidence.
There was very little evidence that abortion was actually dangerous under the current standards. This was actually going to limit access. It already had a bunch of abortion clinics that closed. So it was hard to say that it didn't increase a burden on women trying to get an abortion while not actually providing a health benefit. With this, what's sort of interesting is that it's so, you know, they have mentioned in sort of this proposal that this is for women's health. How exactly is hard to make that connection? And it's hard not to read this as political. Part of it is the fact that Texas lost this case, this case on over HB2. Also recently, and this is sort of where this kind of weird crossover is, there was sort of the issue earlier this year about Planned Parenthood and what they did with fetal tissue that resulted from a terminated pregnancy.
They were accused of essentially black marketing fetal remains and selling them in ways that violated the law, or at the very least was immoral or kind of crass, and all of that really kind of went away. Planned Parenthood had been the subject of a sting by these activist groups that had been involved in these kind of video stings.
Right.
All that kind of fell through.
Well, and I should say, there's no evidence that Planned Parenthood was doing any of that. Just to be
well, that's what I was saying. In terms of it falling through, there were investigations. Nobody found anything.
Right. And in fact, here in Texas, you know, a grand jury impaneled in Houston to look into it actually let Planned Parenthood walk because there was no evidence, and actually indicted the videographer who tried to capture.
Now, those indictments, we should mention, were also dropped in the last week.
And those were dropped in the last week, too. But if you're Texas and you're a Texas lawmaker and you consider yourself pro-life and you consider that to be part of your political persona and part of, you know, something that's important to your constituents, it's been a tough couple of weeks for Texas on the abortion front.
Yeah.
So in some ways, it's hard not to look at this as a way for Greg Abbott to kind of come out and say,
I'm doing something.
Now, again, I think the chances of this surviving any sort of legal challenge are probably slim to none, given what just happened with Texas's omnibus abortion legislation, which is the arguments for women's health there are much clearer. Whereas in this case, what's going to come up is, you know, who's going to pay for this? If women are going to have to be forced to pay for this, it's going to be a burden that has no connection to health, and the court will throw it out.
Right. So we'll wind up seeing what the Department of Health and Human Services does with this. They've now heard the public testimony, and they'll issue some kind of a response to this, either directives or non-directives. Almost no matter what they do,
right,
we can expect to see this, I think, as part of the abortion agenda on both sides come the 2017 legislative session.
Right.
So, all right, one last quick political note, peer politics. Mm-hmm. And this is over the weekend, the Texas Tribune ran a story that was built on a recording that somebody made of a campaign or party meeting, essentially a party organization meeting, the Victory Fund.
Victory Fund.
The Texas
Victory Fund. It's the Texas Victory I don't remember. It's some Texas victory. It's basically the
campaign organization.
It's a campaign organization for Republicans in Texas.
Fundraising, a campaign fundraising organization for Republicans in Texas. The chair of this is George P. Bush, who is the land commissioner and the son of Jeb Bush and the nephew of former governor and president George W. Bush. George P. Bush is seen as kind of a guiding light or a rising star in the Republican Party in Texas by many. He ran and won this land commissioner election in 2014, virtually non-contested.
Right.
Very, very popular with the Bush family fundraising, and with mainstream Republicans, I think, in Texas,
right,
in the party anyway. And at this breakfast, George P. Bush said that, you know, essentially Republicans were going to have to, you know, swallow. I mean, it was a half-hearted endorsement in somewhere, but he basically said we needed to get behind the Republican ticket, even though many of us, in particular my family, have doubts about Donald Trump.
And he had withheld endorsing Donald Trump for a lot of obvious reasons. I mean, his dad had a pretty rough primary campaign against him. I mean, he wasn't expected to run and endorse Trump after it. Although, you know, it's funny, I'm recalling the last Tribune.
Remember, he actually held out on endorsing his dad.
Yeah, so I mean, he certainly takes
another
his time.
Another piece of discussion we had earlier.
Just reminded me, yeah. Yeah, the last Tribune Festival, he was asked if he was endorsing his father, and he sort of demurred, which is, you know.
And that would have been in basically the fall of 2015, going into the heart of the teeth of the primary section.
Right, so if nothing else, we know that he likes to wait to endorse. He likes to hold off. But we were talking about this morning. There's this sort of question of, you know, what are the politics of this for him? Is this really meaningful? And it's a very insidery conversation. I mean, my quick takeaway from the morning was it doesn't affect him in any way, in the sense that, you know, the sort of moderate big donors, Republican donors who he's got connections to because of his father and his uncle and his grandfather, you know, they're not going to turn away from him for this, for a half-hearted endorsement. And then, you know, to the extent that there are some, you know, here in Texas who would, you know, sort of be dissuaded by this, you know, I just don't think it's going to affect him.
Yeah. I think one, you know, as you think back and you think about him not endorsing his own father, I still think there's a little piece of this that makes him look a little flaky. Now, that's a small piece. And I think the dividends for this, and really the takeaway, if you're looking at this and trying to understand this in terms of how politics works, is that here's a guy who has been, as part of his elevation and part of people trying to scaffold his political career, and as an acknowledgement of his ties to the donor community, they put him in charge of this fundraising group. And he is now going to be a party guy by coming out and saying, we've got to get behind the ticket. You know, at a time when there are interesting cross currents in the party, you've got ostensibly, in some ways, major figures in two of the more, you know, diverse wing, you know, the two different kind of opposed wings of the party, neither of whom have endorsed Trump full-throatedly or at all, really, for their own reasons. On one hand, Speaker of the House Joe Strauss, who is seen as, you know, at least insidery, is kind of the bulwark of the center-right kind of establishment wing of the party. And on the other hand, you've got Ted Cruz, who ran against Trump and, as we've discussed in here before, has very pronouncedly chosen not to endorse Trump after, a very bruising campaign. So I think the main thing here is not, I mean, we can go back and forth on, is this good for George P. Bush? Is it not good? But it gives us a little sense about how parties work and how the party in the state of Texas is positioned in an interesting way in the presidential race.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think you mentioned the complexity of sort of this piece, and I think it's useful. We had talked about this last week, and I'll use it as a good way to segue into it. We talked about Paul Ryan, and a lot of, you know, and he's endorsed Trump, but he's also criticized.
That's the Speaker of the House and the Congress.
Right, if you don't know. You know, he's endorsed Trump, but he's also criticized him in recent weeks, and there's been some push among Republican elites for him to disavow him. And you sort of say, what's Paul Ryan's calculus? And something that, you know, the way to look at it is Paul Ryan is Speaker of the House. He's actually voted for, you know, in terms of getting into the Congress among, you know, a congressional district like everybody else, that he's very likely to win again. That's part of why he's Speaker of the House, because, you know, he's not going to get defeated in his own district, number one. It's sort of a necessary condition for being in a leadership position in the Congress at all. but he's also then elected by Republicans in the House to lead them. And so to the extent that he's making a decision whether to endorse Trump or walk away from Trump, he's really looking at what's good for his members in the House. And right now, you know, it's pretty easy to say showing disunity between the Republicans in the Congress and the presidential nominee, he thinks would probably be more harmful to the Republican Party overall and his House members than just, you know, sort of, you know, very reluctantly giving Trump his endorsement and just pushing ahead.
And so you're saying that George P. is being Ryan-esque.
I think everybody's being Ryan-esque, right? Which is, I think, for other officials right now, the question becomes, you know, can Republic, you know, let's say Donald Trump loses by a significant, you know, margin, which is, you know, if you're going to bet, that's what you would bet right now. And again, this will change, but that's a pretty good bet right now. The real question for Republicans is whether they maintain control in the Senate. And what every elected official is kind of doing is saying, what, you know, besides sort of my own personal conditions on the ground, if let's say we set those aside, and for George P. Bush, he has no problems. He's unlikely not to get challenged by anybody serious in a primary next time around. He's not going to lose in a general election in Texas, that's for sure. So basically where you kind of come down with a lot of people is what I'm going to do with respect to Trump more likely to help Republicans in the Senate or hurt Republicans in the Senate, if it has any effect at all.
Right.
And then
how, at the national level.
And then how will that position affect, you know, sort of my political calculus down the road?
Right. And so at the state level, that means George P. is thinking, you know, is it better for me to just get on board with, you know, some amount of, you know, caveating?
Yeah.
That is, you know, sort of qualification than it is to join the crowd of resistance or even remain too silent. We've got to help raise money. He's probably fighting the good fight for the party here, you know, with the sense that, you know, as we were talking about it, it may just be that it, should Trump lose large, given the fact that support and opposition to Trump to some degree cut across the usual factionalism in Texas, that we may just see a case of mass amnesia and forgetting in the state when it comes to what happened with the Trump campaign, should it turn out to be a disaster. Now, we don't know. For all we know, you know, the people that opposed now President Trump, you know, will be in trouble. I doubt that's going to happen, but, you know, we could be looking at that. So with that, I think we will end what is the last second session. For those of you that are in Government 312, good luck with the final. Thanks to our engineer, Will, today. I'm going to have to go get a breakfast taco, and he's going to have to do some editing. Thanks, Josh, and y'all enjoy the rest of the summer. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project and the Project 2021 Development Studio at the University of Texas at Austin.